So are you ready for some political football? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, October the 7th. This is the Week in Review, where we will discuss the top political news stories of the week with two guests from different political viewpoints. And we will give you an opportunity to chime in with your questions and views, too, and give you an opportunity to win the Book of the Week in our Week in Review quiz, which involves that football jingle I just played. It was in the news this week, too, and I'll ask you about that in just a little bit. There were also stories on the campaign trail, the race for president and the race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. There are political fights going on at the state capitol over election rules and the concealed carry law. And there is a big political protest gaining steam, the Occupy Wall Street movement, where protesters are demonstrating against corporations and corporate power and the banks and the politicians that they believe are helping the fat cats and ignoring or hurting the rest of us. The Occupy movement is moving to Wisconsin today, to Madison and to other Wisconsin cities next weekend. So you can join in with your questions and comments on these issues or other topics from the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. We are very happy to have with us Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Joy.
Good to have you back. And joining us for the first time for the Week in Review is Ed Filone, associate professor of law at Marquette University. He's been with us for other programs, but his debut for the Week in Review this week. Thank you very much for joining us, and good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you know, let's start with the unemployment numbers. They just came out. It says here that employers added 103 jobs in September, that is a modest burst of hiring after a sluggish summer, but the job growth remains too weak to lower the unemployment rate, which stayed at 9.1% for the third straight month. Your reaction to that, Chris Lotto?
Well, excuse me. It's been a difficult time for President Obama, and we know that he is feeling the pressure in the face of his approval numbers going downhill. It's been a struggle, and the unemployment rate has stayed above 9%. This comes after the original stimulus bill that Democrats and the president told us was going to get unemployment below 8%. Our country still remains in very serious danger of a double dip in the recession. And, with the elections a year out, we're now seeing the campaign mode from the Democrats and from President Obama. President Obama is out there saying, that it's not him, it's the Republicans' fault, even though he has a majority in the Senate and senators in his own party don't support his efforts at a second stimulus plan. So the latest numbers out this morning are just another indicator that things are not recovering like we all hoped they would. And obviously President Obama's feeling the heat.
Yeah, employers added 103,000 jobs. I guess I left off the 1,000. But Ed Filone, whose fault is this?
Whose fault? Well, there's a structural problem going on. We're seeing, I think, overall in our society, a contraction in the type of jobs available and the number of jobs available in our economy. We have an excess of workers for the jobs that are needed, and that's partly overall changes in technology, new technology, making it easier to eliminate employees. More and more overseas manufacturing being done. It's lost whatever bad stigma it used to have. The companies feel very comfortable moving jobs and production overseas, including service call centers and even more white-collar type work. We also see the fact that, we had a period of, irrational exuberance where companies were expanding too fast, too quickly, trying to chase growth, and it's going to be a while before we're in that kind of environment. So you've got the overall structural problems, there are fewer jobs, and then you've got the fact that the economy, to a great extent, is determined by, dictated by expectations, investment, views of the future. And right now, the businesses out there look at Washington, D.C. They see really little hope of any political agreement there. They look overseas to Europe. They see the economies in Europe teetering on the precipice, and obviously you don't want to be expanding, creating jobs to export goods to Europe when you don't even know what the situation will be there. So this uncertainty is causing a lot of companies to sit on cash. So we're not seeing the kind of natural recovery that historically we've seen. Instead, we're seeing a very cautious, slow recovery. Companies are sitting on cash, waiting to see what happens. And that sort of just feeds into this continuing problem.
Yesterday, the president held a news conference, and he challenged lawmakers to vote for his jobs plan or explain why not. He said this is not a game, and he said that if his plan is not passed, that there could be or will be fewer jobs and weaker growth, and we could also be looking at an economic downturn like what is happening in Europe. Chris Lotto, why not pass this jobs plan?
Well, what the president's up to this week is really obviously campaign mode. He's lashing out at the GOP, as I said earlier, when he doesn't have the support even from his own party in the Senate to move this plan forward. Some Democrats want taxes to be raised and don't think that, even in some cases, that the plan goes far enough. Some moderates have issues with the tax hikes in the president's plan. You know, either way, what President Obama has engaged in this week is really a classic bit of political misdirection by claiming it's the GOP that's standing in the way. It's not his own party. But, you know, he's also setting up the narrative for his campaign going forward. That it's not his own policies that are keeping growth from happening, but you know, it's those darn Republicans that have thwarted him every step of the way. And of course, until we know who Obama's opponent will actually be in the 2012 elections, it's going to be the massive Republicans that are the enemy. You know, it's intriguing because there was a real interesting development on Thursday night with Senate Majority Leader Reid basically triggering what's called the nuclear option to change Senate rules. It's a procedural move that essentially, prevents Republicans from forcing votes on what are termed uncomfortable amendments that are really kind of meant to show that the president does not have support even within his own party on some of these ideas that have been put forward. This is a really rare move. Republicans were legitimately shocked that they were going to go this far. There had been discussion of Republicans actually doing this several years ago, but ultimately, cooler heads prevailed. So this gives you a sense of the tone and the level of, animosity and desperation that's out there right now in this effort at finger-pointing. It's not necessarily productive, but that's the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Ed Filone?
Well, first of all, I don't want to get into this procedural rule change. This is certainly not and the end of the filibuster, and I don't think we need to worry too much about it. In terms of the jobs bill, I think a strong argument can be made that the bill itself is really not strong enough to make a significant difference on the jobs front. As Obama originally pitched it, he was trying to get some stimulative effect, salaries for teachers, police, firefighters, so that public employment would stay at the current level, not get reduced. Extension of unemployment benefits, so those who are unemployed could continue to buy things, consume goods, keep that part of the economy going. And he tried to do it. His original proposal was to limit deductions for high-income couples. And then Harry Reid and the rest of the Democrats, or the Democratic leadership, decided rather than have a more broad-based cap on deductions, let's raise the funds through a tax on those making incomes over $5 million, I think. Really, this is just what most economists, or what some economists, I guess I should say the more liberal economists, say, is that you really need a large stimulus right now, and even if it increases the deficit a little bit in the near term, if it gets the economy going and it allows you the freedom to then take a look at the long-term costs in future years and reduce those, spending a little deficit spending right now in exchange for long-term savings makes the most sense. Instead, we're trapped in this sort of pay-as-you-go, where if you're going to extend benefits to get a stimulative effect, you have to pay for it somewhere, and that means tax increases, which then means a political debate. So we're sort of trapped And I actually agree with Chris that Obama is shifting into campaign mode. But I think that whereas as a president, his attitude of compromise was a weakness up till now, as a campaigner for reelection, being seen as a compromiser, as someone who's trying to do something constructive, even if he's limited in his options, I think that actually plays well for his reelection campaign. I think people are looking for realistic solutions and for something to be accomplished. And right now, Obama's the only person who seems to be trying to do that.
We'll talk a little bit more about the presidential campaign trail as the Week in Review continues. But let's talk now about, and I suspect we'll spend a little bit of time on this one, the Occupy movement. Occupy Wall Street has been going on for like 3 weeks now. It's moving to other cities across the nation. It moved to Washington, D.C. yesterday. It's moving into Wisconsin today, into Madison anyway. There are activists who plan to take over Reynolds Park in Madison starting later today. And next weekend is Occupy Wisconsin, where Milwaukee and Appleton are going to be joining in. Your general thoughts on this movement, Ed Filone, is this the Tea Party of the left? Is this going to make a big difference in terms of the direction this country heads?
Potentially. I mean, it's awful early to see. I mean, I think there are some parallels. I think, first of all, as best as I can tell from the media reports, it does seem to have started as a spontaneous or semi-spontaneous expression of frustration from those on the left who are upset with corporate America and the way in which Washington and the politicians seem to be overly beholden to corporate interests. In much the same way the Tea Party, I think, began as a legitimate spontaneous expression of frustration by those who favored limited government. I think what remains to be seen is the same as with the Tea Party. Is this movement going to get co-opted by more establishment political figures? I think the Tea Party has increasingly become co-opted by Republican candidates and also increasingly intertwined with the religious conservatives. And so it's sort of beginning to lose its spontaneous character and getting incorporated into the broader political structure of the nation. And it remains to be seen whether this Wall Street protest becomes just sort of a flare-out of an expression of frustration by people who don't feel the political process responds to them, but then it peters out, or whether the Democratic Party will seek to sort of direct it and infiltrate it, if you will, and turn it to its own ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you see some parallels, but it's still too early to tell.
Yeah, but before we get Chris's comments on it, what's your impression, Ed Filone, of what the Occupy movement wants? What do they mean when they say we are the 99%?
Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of reading lately about the progressive era, the turn of the century, 1890s through 1920, and there was a great anxiety in the country. We were moving from agricultural to industrial economy, corporate employers. And people were really anxious, what would be our place in this new world where corporations wielded so much economic power? But you had factors such as the rise of unions, World War II, which, you know, increased centralized federal government authority over corporations, so that for a long period of our history, actually, the federal government mediated between people and the new corporate bosses. What we see now that we're reducing the role of the federal government, that old anxiety is coming back. If the federal government is not strong enough to protect workers, are they truly on their own? Who's going to look out for their interests? So I think we're going back to that anxiety from the progressive era.
Mm-hmm. Chris Lauder, your thoughts on the Occupy movement?
Sure. I mean, you know, Ed's been hitting on some good points here, I think. You know, the idea that this is really based on kind of extending what he was saying on class warfare, this 99% idea that there are the haves and the have-nots, and that these groups that are forming are part of the have-nots. And in terms of a political agenda, I mean, it seemed initially that the Occupy Wall Street had an idea. We're, you know, protesting Wall Street. We're protesting the fat cats and the greed and corporate irresponsibility. And as this thing fans out across the country, I think it's getting a little fuzzy-headed. I've read a couple of accounts now in different cities where, you know, reporters approach the organizers and ask what they're there about, and the organizers basically say, well, we'll get back to you on that. So I don't think it has a very clear mission as it branches out. I mean, it's coming to Madison, and we all know Madison never met a protest it didn't like. But, you know, it's been called the left's version of the Tea Party. I agree with that. It's way too early to say that. I think we have a long way to go before this sort of far-flung group of protesters turns into some sort of political force. There are already indications that, that big labor is moving in to kind of co-opt this effort, so we'll see, you know, where that goes. You know, I've seen it referred to in one column as a juvenile rabble, and it looks like in some cases that's how it's shaping up, that maybe for every person that is on point with a message and why they're there and why they're engaging, there's a whole lot of people who are just there for the sake of causing trouble. I think it's showing elements of a form of leftism that kind of threatens to swing so far outside the mainstream that a lot of middle America is going to be turned off. You know, and what I'm referring to specifically is, you know, as we see more stories coming out about, you know, violent confrontations, moves to block roads and bridges, keep people from, you know, just trying to get to work, incidents where protesters are going after the police, you know, that's the type of thing that's going to turn the tide of public opinion against these protesters, and the message can get drowned out by the boorish behavior that's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, you could make the point that, well, that's, you know, that's democracy, it's messy, and but, you know, it also shows that, you know, this is not the kind of protest that you know, folks, I think, on the left and the right in general don't want to see. And that threatens to drown out whatever good points they might be making.
Well, I don't think there has been any violence of any significant nature or any systematic nature. I think that the, you know, sort of the talking point on the right is to tar this group as somehow being violent or having violent tendencies. Just the way that some liberals wanted to look at the Tea Party early on and just scream they're all racist. And, you know, that's just trying to create an image for mass consumption. I think, you know, what really matters is they have a passion. And in today's world, today's political world, there's not a lot of passion. And if that passion is legitimate and if the Democrats can tap into it, then it really is potentially a threat to Republicans.
Let me take a call from Kelly in River Falls. Hello, Kelly.
Great. I support the movement. I'll be going to Occupy Minnesota today and Occupy Madison starting next week. And my grievances are that Washington doesn't listen to us. 80% of us called in and said, don't bail out the big banks and Wall Street, and the government didn't listen to us, Democrats and Republicans alike. 70 to 75% of us asked for a public option or single payer. The government ignored us. 66% of us wanted out of Afghanistan and Iraq. The government ignores us. So what else are we to do? The media won't listen to us, so we go out in the street and we make our voices heard. And as far as it being fuzzy, we have so many grievances against what's going on that it can't be a single issue thing. There are many, many issues. And to tar it as a violent movement is just, that's Rush Limbaugh talk.
Yeah. Kelly, so what are you going to do come election time? Is there a candidate that favors what you favor?
Not unless Elizabeth Warren runs. Otherwise, Barack Obama has lost my vote. He's just the same as the rest. He promised change, and he delivered nothing. So I'm sorry, but I poured my heart and soul into his campaign last time, and I won't be fooled again.
I was wondering, Ed Filone, if you had any thoughts about how these Occupy demonstrations were going to help or hurt the president.
Well, I think they could potentially help the president, because what they're really demanding is that certain options be put back on the table. The Republicans have sort of dominated the rhetoric in terms of saying, well, tax increases are off the table. That's not an option. Government intervention in the economy is off the table. That's not an option. And I think that a lot of people, like the caller, say, you know what, there are options. We should think about these. We shouldn't close the door on them. We want to explore ways to solve our problems, including all possible options. And to the extent that movement gains some strength and it counters the Republican talking points, then it would help Obama, because it would give him more flexibility to reach some sort of a compromise.
Chris Lotto?
Well, yeah, I think the caller was offered a lot of insight, and I actually appreciated his comments and can understand, you know, where he's coming from. I think he made some good points. you know, the fact that this is happening right now, when you have President Obama in office, a Democrat, you have Democrats controlling the U.S. Senate, and still people are getting up in arms, and you heard his list of grievances, and it's long. I mean, these are you know, the failures of the Obama administration. It's not a good sign for him. When his own team starts taking apart what he's doing and taking to the streets to protest. So it's interesting in that regard that they're taking that point. Now, my suspicion is that there's not going to be, you know, anyone who rises out from this movement and becomes the candidate of the, you know, whatever we're calling them, the Occupy Wall Streeters. I don't know if that's as catchy as Tea Party, but there it is. You know, whether somebody's going to rise up and be able to you know, sort of capture the imagination of these groups in 2012. I mean, I have a feeling that a fair number of these folks are angry now, but eventually they're going to look at their options and are going to fall in the line for President Obama. But it is interesting that this is springing up in the middle of Obama's presidency. I mean, a lot of these failures that he ticked off are really Obama's failures.
We will continue talking about the news of the week with Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin, and Ed Filone, an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Coming up, we'll talk more about news from the presidential campaign trail. A couple of Republicans say they will not run. There's also big in the news this week, we lost Apple CEO Steve Jobs, and we'll talk a little bit about his legacy coming up as well. And we welcome your views, your topics from the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Ed Filone and Chris Lotto during this edition of The Week in Review, where we are talking about all the big political news stories of the week and getting their thoughts and yours, too. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And because we have lots of news to cover this week, we only spend a little bit of time on each topic. And let's talk a little bit about New Jersey Governor Christie dropping out of, I shouldn't say dropping out, deciding again that he is not going to run for president. He had some top names in the Republican Party twisting his arm, saying, run, Christie, run. And he said, no, this is not my time this week. Chris Lotto, what do you think?
Well, in general, Republicans are still kicking the tires when it comes to all the candidates. You know, we saw Rick Perry come out of the gate strong. But, you know, in the early going, he's been gaffe-prone and has been struggling a bit. You know, and Republicans are going back to considering all their options, and I think that explains the rise of Herman Cain that we've seen in recent days. You know, to run a presidential race, it takes extraordinary planning, it takes serious resources. It really isn't something you can do on a whim or without having preparation, and I think Chris Christie presumably recognizes this. He looked at the situation, decided that, you know, trying to move in October, you know, little more than a year out from the election day is not something that you can do without proper, you know, preparation. He decided, I think, it was too late, and rather than risk tarnishing his political brand and burning off capital with a hastily considered campaign, now he's chosen to bide his time, and I think that's probably the best for him. You know, it's been said, I heard this from Mary Madeline actually over the weekend on one of the shows, that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And in the presidential race, Republicans just haven't fallen in line yet. I think there's a vacuum, you know, really, at the end of the day among the GOP candidates right now.
And before we get Ed's thoughts, Sarah Palin also said yesterday or day before, nope, I'm not running. Is that any surprise, Chris?
Not really. I mean, I'm sure the late-night talk show writers are disappointed they won't have Sarah Palin to kick around in the race, but it's really not very surprising. Again, it's late in the game to jump in. You know, her brand has been diminished somewhat, I think, for a variety of reasons. I think her deciding to step down as governor of Alaska, I got some questioning her commitment to actually governing. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, there are a number of people out there who are ardent supporters of Sarah Palin, but the numbers have dwindled a bit, and I think the thinking in Republican circles increasingly has been that she should not run.
And when you consider the names that were being floated as the potential savior of the Republican Party, it was Chris Christie that everybody was looking to recently, not Sarah Palin. She does have political capital. She does have strong supporters, as I mentioned earlier. And we'll see what she decides to do with that, if she decides to endorse a presidential candidate or perhaps, you know, try to influence the issues that rise to the forefront in this race. Sarah Palin can still be a force.
And so, as you mentioned, Herman Cain is leading in a couple of polls among the GOP candidates. Ed Falone, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, Sarah Palin was sort of an anticlimax, her announcement, because when she resigned from the governorship in Alaska, I think the common conclusion was she just wanted to make some money, and so that sort of completely diminished her political prospects in the future. Herman Cain is the flavor of the week. He'll rise, he'll fall. We're still hoping for some outside savior to ride in and save the Republican presidential candidates. It's been said that Obama has benefited his entire political career by being lucky. It's better to be lucky in politics than good. He always seems to have a Republican opponent or be running at a time when the Republican Party is self-destructing. And the problem I see with the Republicans is that historically, you wait your turn as a candidate. The party tends to nominate the establishment candidate of long standing who has been patient and a good warrior, and then they get their due. The problem being that person right now would be Romney, who is completely out of step with the Tea Party movement and the more conservative, laissez-faire, extreme laissez-faire wing of the Republican Party. So now the next in line, it turns out, is just out of time, out of, you know, not fitting in the times. And that causes a real problem and a lot of anxiety. And I think that's going to be a severe hurdle for the Republicans in the election.
Yeah, I heard some conservative commentators saying that the Obama administration wants to run against Mitt Romney. Chris Lotto, do you think that's true?
Well, I think Mitt Romney is, in terms of organization, I think he's very strong. I think it seems as though he's learned a lot of lessons from his run in 2008, and I think in a broad sense, he's a better candidate. At this point in time, he wouldn't be my first choice. That's just my personal opinion, and I think a lot of folks are a little mistrustful, and perhaps some of the attacks on his record are resonating with folks. And again, we're still in kick the tires mode on the Republican side of the aisle, but I think things like the health care plan that Massachusetts passed while Romney was governor, there are some factions out there saying that's the precursor to Obamacare. It's flip-flops on some issues that are important to conservatives that have people, not necessarily, giving him a chance in this race. I mean, looking at the field of candidates right now, I do think it's Romney or Perry. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that they're the leaders right now. Herman Cain, as Ed referred to before, and he's right, he is the flavor of the week or the flavor of the month. I think Herman Cain is kind of like the 2012 version of Mike Huckabee. He'll remain a force for a while, and he'll be out there doing his thing, but I think ultimately he doesn't have the support to close the deal.
Of course Obama wants to run against Romney, because Romney can't attack Obama on any red meat issue without Obama being able to respond with a video clip of Romney taking the same position Obama did. I mean, he's embraced abortion rights in the past. He embraced a plan that was with a basis for Obama's health care reform plan. Any attempt to attack Obama can be turned on its head and thrown right back in Romney's face, which severely limits his potential. And also the core conservatives, religious right, have deep suspicions about Romney and are not going to be enthusiastic, whereas I think at the end of the day, the core liberals will float back to Obama. So Romney would be the ideal candidate.
We have another caller. Taylor in Rushford, Minnesota, joins us. Hello, Taylor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with what you said about Herman Cain. He's just the flavor of the week. Rick Perry, too, there was all the hype to get him in, and then he opened his mouth, and everybody realized and looked at his record and thought, well, I guess he's no good. And they're going to do the same with Romney and Bachman. They're going to falter. The Republican Party would, in my opinion, just be stupid to not have Ron Paul as the nomination for president. you can go back to the day he stepped foot in Washington, and he has been the most consistent. He's walked the walk. He talks the talk.
Yeah, well, let's see what Chris Lotto is this the time for Ron Paul.
No, I mean, I don't know that in the presidential race it will ever be Ron Paul's time, although I appreciate where he stands on a lot of the issues. I appreciate the very ardent support that he has out there from a certain segment of the population. I think he is perpetually seen as not ready for prime time, again, as good as some of his ideas may be, and that he just simply doesn't have the level of support out there that he would need to get it over the top. I appreciate what he's saying. I think that the candidates, frankly, in all one way or another, are a little bit problematic. And we're going to sort through this in the months ahead, and it's going to, become increasingly clear. Again, Republicans will, eventually fall in line. I mean, and I think it's Perry's or Romney's to beat. You know, we went through the challenges that Romney faces, and they're formidable. And Perry has his own issues as well. I just don't think that Ron Paul, as passionate as his support is not, going to be ultimately the mainstream Republican choice, the one that gets the nomination. I just don't think he's there.
Yeah, I assume, Ed, you don't think so either?
Well, I actually admire Ron Paul in a certain extent because he is someone who is devoted to his ideology, and he's very consistent, and he puts his ideology above politics. But, I mean, I think Chris's point, as a campaign consultant, he should know. You need to broaden your base. You need to reach out to more voters in order to be a successful candidate. And Ron Paul doesn't seem willing to play politics and to adopt positions for political purposes to broaden his support if that would contradict his underlying ideology. And I can admire that, but it's going to limit his appeal as a candidate.
We need to move on to some other issues. Last week, Bank of America announced that they would be charging $5 a month for the use of debit cards, and they are blaming the new financial regulations for this. And one of the authors of those regulations, Dick Durbin, blasted Bank of America this week, and he encouraged customers to dump Bank of America for this $5 charge. Chris Lotto, what do you make of that?
Well, Dick Durbin is either displaying extraordinary disingenuousness or he's suffering from memory loss. I mean, he helped make this mess, and now he's hypocritically out there bemoaning its impact. And don't get me wrong, when I heard it, I groaned. I'm a Bank of America customer. I believe I have a credit card or two from Bank of America, and the idea that people are going to get charged $5 a month to access their money is ridiculous. And obviously in a recession, that people are going to feel that pinch. What Bank of America is doing is bad news for sure. And it may well give the green light for other big banks to start hiking up their fees as well. In fact, I think I saw a couple others like Citi, I believe, and others that are looking at or are enacting similar plans. But the fact is, this is legislation that Durbin and fellow Democrats wrote, supported, and enacted that put us in this position. The original Dodd-Frank bill was supported by Durbin. It has cut into bank profits, and we can talk about, banks don't deserve all the profits they get, but the fact is it's cutting into their profits. It's encouraging banks to hold on to their money instead of loaning it out. And then Durbin tacks on an amendment that caps banks' per transaction fees for credit and debit card purchases. So this new $5 fee on debit cards is really an effort by Bank of America to get around it and to bring in some money. And now Dick Durbin is out there telling people to drop Bank of America. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a mystifying position. And, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I would hope people don't let him get away with it.
Does it mystify you, Ed?
No, I take somewhat a different view. Sounds like Bank of America is crying, oh, please stop me before I screw consumers again. As if it's Dick Durbin's fault that Bank of America is imposing this fee. I think that, the contrast with Steve Jobs is really illustrative here. The reason why Steve Jobs' passing strikes a chord is that he was the face of the old capitalism, a business that created new products that were attractive to people, that people wanted, that made their lives better, and that they were willing to pay for and build a successful company. Bank of America is the new predatory capitalism. Identify what people do every day in their life and figure out how to charge a toll and make money off of it. So, we've got a captive audience. People have their money in a bank. You really don't have many options other than the financial institution to keep your, you know, have your paycheck deposited. So let's just ramp up the different ways that we can squeeze money. You're looking at consumers not as an audience that you're trying to make their life better and bring exciting new opportunities to, but you're looking at consumers as someone to be squeezed, as a revenue stream. And so that's really, you know, I think why with Steve Jobs passing, people are sort of recognizing, wow, you know, capitalism can be great. You can have your Henry Ford. You can have your Thomas Edison that changes our lives. And with Bank of America, you say, yeah, that's the dirty underside of capitalism.
Because we are running short on time. Chris Lotto, what are your thoughts on the passing of Steve Jobs and the legacy that he left?
Well, you know, when you think about the influence that Steve Jobs and Apple have had on technology and the media over the past decade, not to mention the decades before that, it is mind-blowing. I mean, they have led the way in how we access and digest media. Steve Jobs was an innovator. He was a pioneer. He was a great, you know, American businessman. You know, the areas that they've had influence even beyond media, I think about healthcare as an example, where we're seeing a consumer device, the iPhone and the iPad, that are absolute game changers in terms of how they impact mobility and are changing the face of patient care. You know, first and foremost, their products are simple, intuitive, they're easy to use. My daughter is addicted to our iPad at home. She was able to just pick it up and go to town, our young daughter. We have a bunch of Apple products at home and literally use them every day, and I know we're not alone out there. Certainly my business, Apple, has become almost, you know, indispensable. So, you know, Steve Jobs may be gone, but his impact and legacy will live on, and it is a sizable legacy that he left.
Yeah, new immigration laws went into effect in Alabama that involve checking the immigration status for school children and workers, and this has led to a lot of students and workers skipping school or leaving the state altogether. Ed Filone, since I know you work on these issues involving immigration a lot, I wanted to find out what you thought about this new law in Alabama.
Well, you know, this is a whole other segment for you. I mean, you could do a whole show on
immigration, and we will.
And we have, right? But, well, this is just a continuing trend where immigration to this country and even illegal immigration, all economists, or virtually all economists, have concluded that it gives a net economic benefit to our country. They're not draining resources, but there are specified geographic locations where they bear the brunt because of a very high population there. So it's a distribution problem. And so you have these states who are bearing the brunt, passing restrictive laws. It's a real concern, basically, in a nutshell, because the federal government regulates immigration, and we can't have 50 different states with 50 different laws that sort of try to push immigrants or undocumented people from their borders to their neighbors. You know, it's like the old anti-vagrancy laws during the Depression, where every state would say, you know, if you are homeless, you don't have a job, keep moving, go to someone else, become someone else's problem. We need a one uniform solution, one uniform approach. 50 different state laws is not going to do it, and I would hope that the federal courts would recognize that state laws are preempted by federal law on this issue, but you know, we're getting some inconsistent rulings here, and it's unfortunate because that encourages more states, perhaps Wisconsin, to do what everyone else is doing, and that's not going to work.
Super quick comment, Chris Lotto.
Sure. Well, and Ed is clearly the expert on this, and has done a lot of work on it. I think that he raises an interesting point that as I was reading about this issue, I was wondering about the neighboring states and how they're going to handle what is presumably going to be an influx of folks that are moving out of Alabama. You know, supporters say that it's the federal government that has failed to act to address illegal immigration properly. It's forced the states to take matters in their own hands, and what we're seeing in Alabama, you know, supporters would say this is exactly what they intended. It's self deportation. That they're saying the money is not there in Alabama and these states to pay the bills for illegal immigrants. But we do need to see a federal policy. President Obama has not, you know, stepped up to the plate. I mean, it is, you know, one of those, I would say, third rail issues that nobody really seems to want to touch or deal with in any sort of direct way. But it seems as though a federal policy might be the better way to do it, but we're just not seeing that.
Chris Lotto, is the former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. And Ed Filone is an associate professor of law at Marquette University. And they are our two guests for this week's edition of The Week in Review. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about some news in the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin, a call for toll roads in Wisconsin, election rules changing in the state, and the Week in Review quiz. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Time now for the Week in Review quiz. Here it comes. As of this week, who is no longer ready for some football on Monday nights? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will give you 5 minutes to call in your answer. We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will win a fabulous prize. You will be able to choose from one of the books we featured on the program this week. And we'll get our guest to comment on this at the end of the show as well. Our guests are Ed Filone and Chris Lotto, here with us on The Week in Review. And lots of state issues that we should talk about before our time is gone. Lots of news in the U.S. Senate race this week, including former Governor Tommy Thompson filing for the U.S. Senate race. Looks like he is going to run, Chris Lotto?
Well, it looks like that. It looks that way. It looks like we're going to have a primary, and we may have several candidates in this race. First of all, full disclosure: I have worked with Mark Newman in the race for governor and U.S. Senate, and am supporting Mark in this race. Mm-hmm. What you're going to see, Jeff Fitzgerald, the Assembly Speaker, is making moves to run. Frank Lissay is making moves to run. Tommy Thompson, obviously, and Mark is the Republican candidate, in the race. I think that, almost immediately this becomes really a two-person race. I mean, the two biggest names obviously are Thompson and Newman. And as we've discussed on this program before, the question becomes who is seen as being able to carry the conservative flag. And we know that Tommy Thompson has already been taking his lumps from groups like the Club for Growth, making it clear that they wouldn't support his candidacy. Certainly his record of service in the legislature as governor, in the president's cabinet, decades worth of political service are all worthy of praise. But, I think it's good. I think it's good that the Republicans are going to see, a vigorous primary with several candidates potentially. We'll see how many of them actually ultimately get into the race, but I think this is a good thing. On the Democrat side of the aisle, it's pretty clear that Tammy Baldwin is heading toward the nomination without any significant opposition. So we're shaping up to see a battle where it's really going to be the most liberal member of Congress facing off against potentially one of the more conservative members of Congress back in the 90s. So I think the battle lines in this race are pretty clearly going to be drawn.
Yep. Ed, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's going to be Thompson and Newman on the Republican side because they're the only two candidates who can raise the money necessary to run a Senate race. And I think, in a lot of ways, Thompson is the worst nightmare for the Republican establishment because he could potentially, because of his name recognition and fundraising skills, he could potentially win the Republican nomination but have his campaign sort of self-destruct. There's all sorts of potential problems in his background that could derail his candidacy at a later date. And so I think, many in the establishment would prefer that he just not run or get defeated early on. Worst case scenario would be he collapses late in the game. But we'll see what happens.
In other election-related news, the Government Accountability Board this week walked back on a plan to allow customized recall petitions to be downloaded, and Democrats are upset. At first, they were mad at Republicans for trying to overrule the Government Accountability Board on some of these rules, and now they're saying the GAB caved under Republican pressure. What do you think of this, Ed Filone?
Well, I think that there's been increasing attention to the electoral process in this country, and it makes sense because, demographics is destiny, and if you look at demographic trends, the Republican Party increasingly is looking at itself as getting older and whiter and less numerous. So access to the ballot becomes an important counterweight. And what started as sort of a voter ID, let's protect the vote, let's protect integrity movement, which is at least theoretically defensible, has now simply become an effort to jury-rig election procedures in ways that protect incumbents or preserve a temporary majority. And I'm really troubled by that. I mean, the electoral process is what makes democracy work, and people have to have belief that they can use the electoral process to affect change. And when we start to see too much stacking of the deck using these procedures in favor of one political party, then people realize the electoral process won't work, and then they seek other options. So I'm very troubled by all this.
Yeah. Are you, Chris Lotto?
No. I mean, this has been an effort to sort of grease the skids and make the process easier, by changing the rules of the game. I mean, this was not in place before, and this is coming as the left gets ready to try and recall Governor Walker. And this proposed rule change would have clearly made it easier to gather petition signatures, potentially easier to commit fraud. I think it's going to be hard enough to force a recall against Governor Walker, and it's a process that I don't think is going to be successful anyway. But, you know, it is work to gather recall petition signatures, and particularly in a race of this potential size. I mean, you're talking hundreds of thousands of recall petition signatures, and this would have taken a lot of work to get it done, as it should. I think Republicans were right to block it, and apparently in their rush to do what they think is the will of the people, Democrats seem to forget that what goes around comes around. This is the kind of effort that may generate a short-term win for them, but would only be a matter of time before it's used against them.
A report out this week from the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute calls for toll roads in Wisconsin, or at least says that a toll system would help pay for the crumbling interstates. And I'm wondering, Ed Filone, if you think toll roads in Wisconsin are a good idea or not.
Well, I tend to be neutral on toll roads. I think that to the extent that the burden and cost of maintaining the highways gets passed on to those who actually use them, toll roads can be productive. There's plenty of urban residents who don't use the interstate and the highways, outside of the Milwaukee area, who yet keep their tax dollars fund the upkeep. So if toll roads really can shift the cost to those who use the roads, then I'm, in favor of that. The difficulty is that people evade tolls, and so the real question is, will they be effective? Will we just turn certain segments of the highway into sort of deserted areas because everyone's on the surface roads and avoiding the tolls?
Yeah.
But, I wait and see.
The governor this week did tell Wisconsin Public Radio that he would consider a hot lane or an express lane toll as a possibility in the future. Chris Lotto, do you think we'll ever see that?
Well, it's possible. It's funny. I drove to Cleveland to visit the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame about a month ago and was reminded of one reason why I love Wisconsin, and that is we don't have toll roads. I would hope that Governor Walker would resist the urge to go down that road, no pun intended. Actually, it was a pun intended. But, the hot lane idea where it's an optional, where it's a choice that motorists can make, obviously once you open that door, we start moving down the road to just enacting toll roads entirely. But if we have to do it, at least if it's optional, Governor Walker, as you said, has left the door open to that. So that would be more palatable than, the more broad-based options that are, in our neighboring states like Illinois.
The National Rifle Association wrote a letter to Attorney General Van Hollen this week, upset because apparently the Department of Justice is requiring 4 hours of hands-on firearms training in order to do the concealed carry thing, and NRA says that's not what the law says. Ed Filone, your thoughts on this?
It's kind of a mock debate, isn't it, between an extreme gun rights attorney general and an extreme gun rights organization? I'm not sure it's really a debate. I mean, it's just a little discussion going on from one side of the issue. My immediate reaction was that it's designed to create the illusion that whatever rules come out are some sort of middle of the road, reasonable rules. When in reality, if what they're talking about is 4 hours of training to have a lethal weapon on the streets, to my mind, that's not adequate.
Yeah, Chris Lotto, quick thoughts. We're almost out of time.
Well, sure, very quickly. I think that I've never been opposed to the idea of a reasonable small amount of training to in order to carry a concealed weapon, and I don't see that as a problem for folks who want to do this. So, you know, and certainly I would support the idea that they get a little bit of training before they go out armed.
Congratulations to Marilyn in South Range. She is the winner of this week's Week in Review quiz. She correctly answered that Hank William Jr. is no longer ready for some football on Monday nights after a run of 20 years. He will no longer kick off Monday Night Football. Last weekend on Fox and Friends, Williams said that President Obama playing golf with John Boehner was like Hitler playing golf with Netanyahu. And after that made it into the news, ESPN skipped the song last Monday. And this week, Williams says he's pulling the song from ESPN. And ESPN said they were parting ways with Williams. Very quickly, Ed Filone, do you think that that those comments should have gotten Williams kicked off of this show?
You don't have a First Amendment right outside of the public context. Employers can always tell you that you're being offensive and fire you.
All right.
So, yeah,
we'll leave it there. Chris, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Joy and Ed.
Thanks.
Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party, and Ed Filone, associate professor of law at Marquette University. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.